to 101.
Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I've got a really important question to ask you right off the bat. Should somebody at Portland Public Schools go to jail when a 9-year-old girl is gang raped in a school bathroom and the school decides not to call the police? Now, just think on that for a moment. I'll give you the details in a moment as well. And of course, there hasn't been much reporting on this locally at all. And it's amazing. A 9-year-old girl is raped. A $9 million lawsuit is filed because of that crime. It is never investigated as a crime, and it's not reported to the police as a crime. And just think about that for a moment. Welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you want to join what I call the best conversation and talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. I imagine I might get a couple of naysayers today on this. So if you're a naysayer, you go right to the head of the line by just calling in to 866-439-5277. You can vote in our poll on X. And today's poll on X found at Lars Larson Show. Should the rules forbid a president from firing bureaucrats who won't do their jobs as they're told? Well, the Biden administration is putting together some brand new rules because I think Joe Biden and the people around him have just about resigned themselves to the fact that Donald Trump is going to win the presidential race about 7 months from now. I think they've already decided it's game over. So they're putting together a plan that will restrict future presidents from unilaterally nixing civil service protections. Because whether you know this or not, in the federal government, once you're hired, once you're on the job, once you're in civil service, it becomes extraordinarily difficult to fire you, even if, number one, you're not doing your job, or number two, you're actually violating the rules or even violating the laws. It is just about impossible to get rid of bad employees in the federal government. Now, America was once a country when a new president would come in, virtually all of the top positions, not just the cabinet jobs, but an awful lot of the federal bureaucracy would change with every single president. Frankly, I'd like to get back to those days, because when you pick a president like Donald Trump, but you have a bureaucracy that was largely put there by liberals, both liberal Republicans and liberal Democrats, how much change can you actually bring about? And you can't imagine this happening in private industry. I mean, imagine somebody new takes over at Boeing, as somebody new is going to take over at Boeing. And then everybody in the departments down below the C-suite says, we're not doing anything this new guy or gal tells us to do. We're just not going to cooperate. Well, if that's the case, you get fired. In the federal government, you don't get fired. So you've got the Biden White House right now trying to lock things down so that Donald Trump, as the new president, and as I said, it seems the Biden White House has already decided that Donald Trump is all but inevitable, that when he arrives, he will be unable to get rid of uncooperative bureaucrats who won't do the job the way they're directed. Because after all, those bureaucrats work in the federal bureaucracy, the executive branch of government, and they can be told what to do by the people above them. And at this point, they can apparently ignore what they're told to do. And Joe Biden wants to lock that in. Consider that question. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. And it's always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. I'll tell you my opinion on this Portland public school situation, which is so outrageous. But let me give you the details so you understand everything that happened. I believe that somebody at Portland public schools, maybe more than one person, needs to go to jail when a 9-year-old girl is gang raped in a school bathroom. The school learns of it, and I'll tell you about that as well. And the school says, we're not going to report this to the police. We're going to investigate it ourselves. Because, as you know, every school principal, assistant principal, they're all expert criminal investigators. You may not have known that before, but apparently at Portland Public Schools, one of the side talents of being a principal, vice principal, superintendent, or whatever, is that you're an expert criminal investigator and that you're capable of even investigating some of the worst crimes there are, like sexual abuse of a 9-year-old girl. Oregon's mandatory reporting law, at least on paper, makes failure to report even a suspected sexual abuse of a child is a crime. In other words, if you don't report and you're one of the mandatory reporters, including teachers, including nurses and doctors and a lot of other people in society, if you don't report it, you have committed a crime as well. Well, a brand new lawsuit says that the 9-year-old girl was coerced into a school bathroom by two boys, stripped and raped by the two boys. That happened 2 years ago. And the father of one of the boys, and I say God bless him, found out that his son had been involved in doing this, and to his great credit, he reported it to Portland Public Schools. He should have picked up the phone and called 911. That's the only improvement I'd make, because guess what Portland Public Schools did? PPS decided not to call police. They did their own investigation, and get this, they suspended the boys for 1 day. You commit what appears to be a criminal act, and if they were ever accused of that criminal act, sure, give them their day in court. Put them in front of a judge. In fact, in Oregon's system, since children technically are not found guilty of crimes, they're either found as a dependent of the court or under the jurisdiction of the court. It's the juvenile equivalent of being convicted. So they can decide either this is a kid who needs help, or this is a kid who has committed the child equivalent of what would be a crime if you're an adult. But in either case, a judge gets to look at that and decide, does this child need punishment? Or does this child need help? And judges do that all the time. So the father did the right thing. Then PPS didn't call the police. They did their own investigation, suspended the boys for one single day. Bad boys, you get a slap on the hand for rape. What kind of message does it send to the boys or any of their friends or the girls in the school? Now, the girl's father immediately tried to get his daughter moved to another school and moved away from her rapist. PPS took a month to get that done. Apparently, the hashtag MeToo philosophy has not quite reached the halls of the Portland Public Schools. Now, I've called the Portland Public Schools. I've called three of their information specialists, and I've said, I'd like to get some kind of explanation. Why did you violate the mandatory reporting law in the case in which a 9-year-old girl has been apparently raped by two boys, and why was the punishment just 1 day of suspension? I'll tell you what. The schools are now facing a $9 million lawsuit from the girl's family, and frankly, I hope they win every dime. Reporters should be demanding of the schools that they identify every single official who violated the mandatory reporting law. Do we need any more reasons to get your kids as fast as possible out of the toxic government-run schools where they're not learning, and apparently in this case, they are literally in danger? It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Your phone calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. The Northwest Nonsense is coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network.
On the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Well, Seattle has determined that too many of those nasty little oppressor white kids make up the classes in its gifted education program. So the public schools have said the answer is shut the whole thing down. Apparently, there are a lot of smart Asian kids in there, too, so that's gone. For the black kids that this was supposed to benefit, and there are some black kids in the gifted program, well, I guess they just got caught in the crossfire. Seattle Public Schools claim that all of this happens in the name of equity. That strange idea where unless a program works out with results just as good for all kids of all colors, none of them get to go. Do you understand that logic? Because if you do, be a naysayer and call the show. I don't get it at all. The Democrat Party, which runs the whole shebang, Seattle Public Schools, doesn't really need smart voters at election time. They need compliant citizens, preferably those who are dependent on the government, so they'll vote for the right candidate. So SPS plans to shovel all the kids into the same classroom. The slow ones, the fast ones, and those in the middle. They can all be dumbed down to the lowest common denominator. They call it the whole classroom model. I call it the mediocrity model. All the government-run indoctrination factories, that's K through 12 government-run schools, are missing now is one of Kurt Vonnegut's handicapper generals to run the curriculum. Or maybe they can get the president to come dedicate the new program. You know, the same Joe Biden who only 5 years ago said, quote, poor kids are just as bright and talented as white kids. The same Joe Biden who as a young senator endorsed school skin color segregation this way, quote, unless we do something about this, my children are going to grow up in a jungle. The jungle being a racial jungle, that's Joe Biden speaking, with tensions having built so high, it's going to explode at some point. Seattle schools seem to be headed down a path that Joe Biden would actually agree with. Our question of the day comes in from Robin Fisher. Hey, Lars, last week I got a letter from my doctor at Oregon Medical Group stating he was leaving his practice there. As you probably heard already, this was the lead topic from local news in Eugene last night. Optum, which I understand is a corporate entity, has purchased Oregon Medical Group. And over this time, there's been a mass exodus of primary doctors, leaving hundreds of patients to fend for themselves. My question now is this. Are we on the brink of socialized medicine? Signed, Robin Fisher. Well, Robin, I think Joe Biden would like to see us get to socialized medicine, and it will be the same kind of disaster that it is for people in Canada, Great Britain, and Scotland. So, on that note, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our poll on X. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show on X and on our website at LarsLarson.com. And if you're a naysayer, of course, we'll put you right to the head of the list. I mean, maybe you're one of those people who's a naysayer who believes that the Portland Public Schools, when they become aware of a 9-year-old girl being raped, and by the way, we've had a couple of calls from people saying she was 14. She was not. She was 9 years old. She was in third grade. That when a rape occurs at school, that it's the school that investigates that crime, and it's the school that decides the punishment. In this case, a one-day suspension for those involved on the assault or in the assault on the little girl. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I want to give the Daily Grill to somebody in advance. It's Chuck Schumer, senator from this great state of New York. And next week, he's planning to bury the impeachment against Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas without even holding a trial as the Constitution requires. You know that when the House of Representatives votes to impeach a federal official, the Senate is expected to hold a trial. That's what it says in the Constitution. Now, I think it's important that the Senate actually do its constitutional duty, consider the evidence, hold a trial, and then what the Democrats are trying to avoid, make a decision. Do you vote to acquit Mayorkas? Let me point out to you, the impeachment articles that are going over to the Senate on Senator Secretary Mayorkas's willful and systematic refusal to comply with the law when it comes to America's border and his breach of public trust. The articles detail seven provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act that Mayorkas has violated. Now, if you want high crimes and misdemeanors, is seven violations of federal law enough for you? As well as numerous occasions that he has lied to the Congress, lied to the American people to hide the results of his policies on America's southern border. And this impeachment goes beyond a difference on policy. The Secretary of Homeland Security has knowingly and willfully violated America's immigration laws. And if the Democrats decide to bury this, we're going to remind them about it forever. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And today's best one comes from Denise Warner. Lars, about that subject you were talking about, she wrote in because I talked about the fact that the state of Oregon has had a completely inadequate unemployment system computer for about 15 years. And how do I know that? Because accidental governor and before that Secretary of State Kate Brown actually did an audit of the employment division and determined that if that computer had any kind of extra stress on it, it was going to absolutely melt down. Well, what happened during the pandemic? It melted down. And tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people were denied the unemployment checks that they had actually earned. And they needed them badly. So Denise was talking about the fact that earlier this year, a month ago today, the state of Oregon cranked up its brand new, brand spanking new $100 million replacement computer system. They had 15 years to plan it. They then had a week to actually install it. They had plenty of time. They had plenty of money. They spent over $100 million on this thing, and now it doesn't work. And there are a lot of people out there who have legitimately filed for unemployment checks, and they're not getting them, including her fiancé. And Denise says, I meant to say, what does his gender identity or sexual orientation have to do with unemployment? Those are some of the questions that are being asked of people who are filing for unemployment. She says the other part of the coin is that he's been trying to call for a week to get through to a human being. And after waiting 4 hours on hold, it automatically hangs up on him. I told him maybe he didn't answer the gender identity question the right way for them to give him service. Well, I wouldn't put it past Salem from saying, hey, if somebody won't identify themselves by their proper pronoun, if they won't fully embrace all the transgender LGBTQ nonsense, then no unemployment check for you. I don't know. If there's a better explanation, I'd be glad to hear it. Glad to have you with me on a Thursday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our poll question today, should the rules forbid a president from firing federal bureaucrats who won't do their jobs? I would say, no, the rules should not forbid a president from doing that, but Joe Biden is writing exactly those rules. Coming up in just a moment, illegal aliens, refugees, and the homeless have invaded the tennis courts at Seattle's Garfield High School. Is that what you want your education tax dollars going to? We'll get to Jonathan Cho, the journalist from Seattle, and we'll get to your calls in a bit at 866-439-5277. You've got the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Google. Yeah, he's everywhere. The Lars Larson Podcast.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your calls. I want you to consider this. When you invite about 10 million people to come into your country, and you tell them they have rights under the Constitution, they have rights under the law, should we be surprised when some of those people begin to engage in what I would consider extortion? And let me describe that, and then I want to get to our friend Jonathan Cho. So you have a bunch of illegal aliens given a free place to stay at a hotel. But when the hotel money runs out, they move themselves, at least for a few hours, to the tennis courts at a Seattle public high school. And they stay there until somebody pays their bill, and then they go back. To me, that seems like simple extortion, and that Seattle Public Schools and apparently the city of Seattle have allowed themselves to be extorted. Now, I wouldn't put those words in the mouth of a straight-ahead journalist like Jonathan Cho, but I am glad to welcome him back to the show. Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
I mean, Lars, I think you hit it on the head. That's what it looks like, right? Call it what it is.
Yeah, you will pay our hotel bills, or we will camp out at your high school on the tennis courts. And how long did this go on? And would you mind sketching this out so the people listening around the Northwest can hear what was going on yesterday at Seattle's Garfield High?
Yeah, basically, let me be very clear. This is a group of about, a couple hundred migrants from Venezuela and Angola. And they initially started in Tukwila, Washington, about 15 minutes away from Seattle, at Riverton Park United Methodist Church last year. But during the cold spell, they demanded hotels. So the church paid for some of those hotel rooms. But when the money ran out, they marched to Seattle City Hall and demanded money. The mayor caved, gave them money. But when that ran out, they went to the King County Council. They got money. But when that ran out, they called a protest on Wednesday. They contacted all the local media, and they said, meet at Garfield. We're going to take over the tennis court until the city funds us. Last minute, an interfaith group came in for about a week and a half's worth of, hotel room stays. So the question now becomes, what happens after the money runs out again? But basically, it was a spectacle yesterday, Lars. You had, dozens of tents taking over a tennis court. People had to cancel their appointments, and they were making the activists were making demands. I want to be very clear. The migrants who barely speak any English are being used right now by the far-left activist class. These are the same folks who are leading the pro-Palestine protests here in Seattle, and they align themselves with a lot of Marxist and communist causes in this region.
So we got a lot of people being taken advantage of. Taxpayers That's are being right. taken advantage of. These migrants, or illegals as I would call them, are being taken advantage of because they're being used as a political tool or political pawns. And then, of course, we got the faith-based groups and all those who are being extorted. And if we've had this happen four times now with this one group, is there any doubt in your mind that in 10 days when the money runs out of the hotel, that they won't just turn around and do the same thing all over again? And maybe other groups will see what they're doing and say, hey, that works. You can extort the Americans, just threaten them in some way, set up on the grounds of their high school where their kids go to school, and you'll get what you want.
Well, look, District 3 council member here in Seattle, Joy Hollingsworth, leads the Central District, a historically black neighborhood. And she put out a statement saying, look, the state legislature just approved $30 million for housing and resources for these asylum seekers. The problem is they don't know when the money it will be released. So there is no doubt that this group will try again. And it really is a shame because you have also homeless advocates here in the Seattle area now realizing, wait a second, what about the Americans, the veterans, the families and children who are homeless, who are being told by the state and the city they don't have money? But then they're looking right across the street and all of these migrants now are getting free resources and motel rooms now? It just doesn't make sense. Give me a break, Lars.
Well, and Jonathan, the numbers scale up pretty fast. Does anybody even have any accurate count for how many of these refugees might be in the Puget Sound region? I mean, is it thousands? Is it tens of thousands? Do we know?
We don't have an exact count. It really depends on which agency you ask. But if you go to Riverton Park United Methodist Church, that kind of allowed all of this to happen in Tukwila, at one point they were reaching close to maybe 400 or 500. And the pastor refuses to turn anybody away. So word is getting out into the illegal immigrant community, basically, in other countries. And they're going on social media now, right? I mean, it's making national news. People going on social media, these migrants, and saying, come to America. We have free resources here. And now they're saying, come to Seattle. They're going to give you motel rooms. They're going to give you vouchers. They're going to give you gas cards until your asylum hearing, which in many cases is several years away.
Well, the reason I brought up the numbers, Jonathan, because right in line with what you were saying, I watched a lady a few weeks ago in Denver where they estimate there are 40,000 of these people. Now, maybe there aren't nearly as many in Seattle, but with 40,000, she said, if you could secure housing for as low as $1,000 a month for 40,000 people, that's $40 million a month. That's $500 million a year, and that's just housing. That's not housing and food and medical and transportation and everything else that goes with the package. And she said, are you ready to commit $500 million a year to this? If the, even if the numbers are lower, say it's 5,000 in the Puget Sound region. Well, that's 5,000 times 1,000 a month is 5 million times 12 months is 60 million bucks. And that's, as I said, just housing. Not that I think you can necessarily find housing for 1,000 bucks a month in the Puget Sound metro.
Yeah, and think about what you just said. Let's say all those numbers, you know, are ballpark figures. You could solve the homeless crisis here in this region, if that's the case. And I think that's what's so baffling for so many people, right? And not to mention the drain on 911 resources, their constant altercations at these migrant camps now. And the kids, once the school year begins, you know, next year, where are they going to go? Are they going to start flooding the classrooms here in the Seattle region?
They will. Jonathan, you know, there was a Supreme Court decision close to, I think it was 40 years ago, might have been closer to 50 years ago, that said, even if you're illegally in the country, your children have a right under the U.S. Constitution go to public schools. And you may agree with that or disagree with it, but it's the law right now. And so when Seattle taxpayers, public school taxpayers are hearing, we don't have enough teachers, we don't have enough this, that, or the other thing to meet the needs of your kids. And oh, by the way, we've had a bunch of it diverted to these newcomers, as Joe Biden calls them. I just wonder how even a very liberal bunch, but like voters in Seattle, are going to respond to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, we're just going to have to wait and see. But this is an untenable situation, and it's getting worse and worse, Lars. And I called this last year. At the end of last year, I said this was going to be one of the biggest stories of 2024, and it's turning out that way.
Yeah, it certainly is. And by the way, tell people where they can find your reporting, Jonathan, because we're always impressed.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You know, you can find a lot of my work at fixhomelessness.org or a lot of my social media platforms at Choshow, Choeshow, primarily on X.
Very good. Thank you very much. That's Jonathan Cho, the journalist in Seattle, talking about illegal aliens who now four different times have extorted money and lots of money. Imagine what it costs to put a couple of hundred people in a local hotel, even at budget rates. Can you imagine how much that costs per week, per month, and then all the other resources? And their answer has become, if you don't give us exactly what we want, then we are going to extort it from you. We will do something threatening, like we're going to set up an entire community on the grounds of your local public high school. And when you're worried about your kids, because there have been schools that have been surrounded by not just illegal aliens, but also by homeless and drug addicts and criminals and the rest. And parents are right to be concerned about that and to say, well, schools, what are you going to do about it? And they say, not our job. And the police are going to say, not our job. And the city council, county commission, the rest of them will say, it's not our job. It's somebody else's job. And of course, Joe Biden, whose job it is to safeguard America against invasion by illegal aliens, he's doing this on purpose. Just remember that in this election year. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails, talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll or X poll. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Political climate. He's the steamroller. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and here's a conspiracy theory for you. Do you draw the same conclusion I do when I say that I think Joe Biden and the White House and the campaign have now decided Donald Trump is inevitable as the winner in November? Why else would the Biden administration, and this is from Politico, which, if anything, tilts a little bit to the left, Politico says the Biden administration put the finishing touches today on a plan to restrict presidents from unilaterally nixing civil service protections from large swaths of the federal workforce as former President Donald Trump renews his vow to uproot a deep state if he is returned to the White House. What this means, in short, there was once a time in America, quite some time ago, where when a new president came in, an entirely new bureaucracy, or largely new bureaucracy, came in. with every new president. Now, we have presidents who come and go, and the bureaucracy stays there for decades. And it has become virtually impossible to get rid of bad bureaucrats, even when they're especially bad because of civil service protection. It's one of the reasons you can change presidents, and it's very difficult for a new president like Trump in January to get things done, because the civil service people know they're virtually bulletproof. So, on that note, you can answer the question, should the rules forbid a president from firing bureaucrats who won't do their jobs? I said, no, the rules should not forbid a president from doing that. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. I love naysayers. John is a naysayer from Bellingham, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. John, what do you and I disagree about today?
Mr. Larson, first of all, thank you for your reporting on that horrendous situation in the Portland Public Schools.
I was glad to make it apparent to people, because it's so ugly. It has to be fixed. And so many people at Portland Public Schools who broke the law.
Hey, absolutely. And certainly that's the case. But did I hear you correctly? Your last sentence was, the school district is rotten and you should pull your children.
Yes. Yeah, that was the gist of it. I said, look,
I think that's a bridge too far.
Okay, can I give you some data to back it up?
Certainly.
Okay, the dropout rate in both Oregon and Washington is higher than the national. So they give up on those kids. Roughly 20% of the kids drop out, in some cases higher, but about 20% Oregon and Washington. Of the 80% who stay behind, about half of them are considered proficient, good enough in reading, writing, and math. The other half are not. So it's like running a factory where you produce 10 items, two are thrown right in the garbage, and four of the other eight are not worthy of being put out for public consumption. So it's failing on education. And we have schools that are demonstrably dangerous to children, where children may be raped, children may be beat up, children may be killed, and in some cases these days, your kids may be mutilated, sexually mutilated, with the assistance of people in the schools. Do you think that's a toxic environment?
Yes, I would agree with that, but
okay,
I would hope
the kids out.
The appropriate would be to go fix it.
There is no, look, John, people have been trying to... People have been trying to fix the public schools for a long time. And if anything, the unions have worked at cross purposes to that. They have said, you will not downsize. You see that both in Seattle and Portland, when the number of kids in school, and it's dropped nationwide by millions as parents have found out what was going on in the schools and pulled their kids out. And when the population drops, would you guess the funding goes down as well?
Yeah, funding is per student.
It does not. The funding goes up. So in other words, the teachers say, we demand more money for teaching fewer kids. So the unions will fight every effort at change to fix this. And John, I'd ask you this. I mentioned the mandatory reporting law. There is one of those in all 50 states, 58 if you're an Obama voter, but 50 for the rest of us. So you have a law, and here's how simple it is. It says, John, if you are a teacher today, or an administrator, or a principal, or vice principal, superintendent, whatever, if you even suspect that a child has been sexually abused at school or elsewhere, you are required by law to report to the police or to Child Protective Services, which is functionally the same thing. And if you do not, you have committed a crime by failing to do it. Is that pretty simple to understand?
No, absolutely, and
okay.
I completely concur.
Well, but go back to the facts of this case,
John. The
teacher
union thing is a major problem as well.
Yes, it is, and you're not going to change that dramatically in the Northwest. So let's go back to this case, the case of the 9-year-old girl. So the father of one of the boys, the way parents almost always figure out the nonsense their kids are up to, he realizes my son has been involved in the sexual assault on a girl. And I said, God bless him, because he did the right thing. I think a lot of parents might have said, I'm not turning my kid in. So he calls the schools. He should have called the police, but he calls the schools and said, look, my son was involved in a sexual assault on a girl at the school. Now, if you're the administrator, and the secretary gets the call, but the call goes right through to the big boss, you would expect, because the secretary says, I got a guy on the phone says his son was involved in sexually assaulting a girl at school. Now, when you get that call and you get those details, is there any, would you have any difficulty at all determining I must report this to the police under the mandatory reporting law?
Not at all. Those people should be hammered.
So when they don't do it and they have committed a crime, the teacher involved, the principal involved, the superintendent involved, and I bet that principal called the superintendent and said, hey, I got this sexual rape of a child. What do you want me to do? And they said, handle it internally. You should take everybody who violated that law, everybody who's helped making the schools a toxic place, and you should put them up on criminal charges. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And consider this poll on X question today. Should the rules forbid a president from firing bureaucrats who won't do their jobs? I'd say no to that. You can vote any way you like. You'll find the X poll question at Lars Larson Show on X. Also on our website at LarsLarson.com and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I want to talk about teachers and unions and lying to the public to make more money. And Paul Guppy joins me now, who's vice president for research at the Washington Policy Center. Paul, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
I'm glad to have you on for your expertise. Did the Washington Education Association and other teachers' unions lie to the parents and the taxpayers about COVID in an effort to make more money?
Yeah, the answer is yes, and it's not just us saying that. That is backed up by research by the New York Times, which found that in the fall of 2020, there was enough scientific information from the CDC to show that schools could open safely across the country, and in many states they did open, but not in Washington State. The union pressured the governor to keep the schools closed for a full academic year after that. And then we did the follow-up research here locally in the state and found that during that same period, top union executives, the president of the union, the executive director of the union, were pulling down salaries of between $300,000 and $400,000. That's all during a time when the schools, the public schools, that is, were completely closed.
Yeah, because for the teachers, unlike a lot of people in the private sector, the paychecks kept on coming, whether they taught, whether they showed up in the classroom or not.
Exactly. Now, you know, the union would say, well, there was online education that teachers were still showing up and trying to teach their students. And we have to hand it to those frontline classroom teachers that did try to stay in touch with their students and advance some learning that way. But as all parents, you know, myself included, if you're sitting at home with your struggling school-aged child, within a week or so, you quickly found out that the online education just wasn't working at all. And a lot of students didn't pay any attention. A lot of classes didn't happen. So even though they were technically working, quote unquote, there really wasn't much learning activity going on. And there was zero activity going on as far as the union is concerned. And yet we found that all union executives still pulled their full salaries during that period.
Yeah, and there was no reason for them to do that. I mean, who are they representing? I guess they could argue, well, we had to represent the teachers because, after all, it was a changing landscape as the rules and whether or not they were going to be open or not were changing as well. But it seemed to be mostly Republican-led states where the schools reopened, and other states like Oregon and Washington, where they were run by Democrat officials, those were the places where the schools stayed closed.
Exactly right. And again, as a research organization, we always look for real-world control groups that show how students would have fared if the shutdown rules didn't apply. And you're right. There are countries like Sweden that didn't close down at all. There are states, over 20 states in the U.S. did not close their schools. And then right here in Washington State, private schools and charter public schools opened a year before the regular public system, and those students did fine. So there are many comparisons, objectively following the science, that show that public schools could have opened in the fall of 2020, about 4 or 5 months into COVID. We had enough information to know that younger children are practically unaffected by the disease. Also, that they don't tend to carry it to other people. We knew that in 2020, and yet the union insisted on keeping the public schools closed anyway.
You know, Paul, I remember when we found that out, because there was a concern early on, and I thought, well, a lot of times, whether you like it to hear it or not, kids are disease vectors, except it turned out not to be the case with COVID. But there are a lot of other diseases, including nasty ones like hepatitis, where kids can be carriers of it without even showing any symptoms. But they found that out fairly early that they were not. So were you able to pull out any records that showed, you know, where the unions or the state officials admitted they knew that they could reopen and they decided not to anyway? Were you able to get to that?
Well, yes, because the union itself said that they were following information that came from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control at the federal level. That information showed, as I mentioned, that schools could open safely. Private schools, charter schools, and schools in other states did do that with no damaging health effects to students or to the faculty. And yet at the same time, the same union was putting out public statements, and I have some quotes here. One union leader in Washington State said, "Teachers will die if students go back to school." Another one said, "We shouldn't worry about students falling behind because they're all falling behind together. So it doesn't matter if they're not learning." These are the public statements that they were making at the time when, again, they knew from science and research that came from the federal government that safely opening a school was possible in Washington, and yet the union continued to argue against it.
You know, Paul, there was another issue I wanted to ask you about that relates to this, but are there any other major findings from this that you'd like to share with my audience?
Well, that's basically it. I could go into lots of detail, but I think what people, you know, what we know now from the record is just what I described. They could have opened the schools, but the union didn't want to.
By the way, the one that's bothered me, and I've never seen anybody but this show report on it, is this. And I don't know how widespread it was, but I'll bet you could get the data. And that was the schools, some of them at least in Oregon, decided to game the system. And by that, I mean this. The schools said, okay, all you teachers, you are officially laid off on Friday, and then you're back to work on Monday. So they had the teachers working 4 days a week, and they collected full paychecks. And what that did during that period where you could collect both unemployment plus $600 a week if you were on unemployment, they qualified their teachers for a day of unemployment to get them the $600 a week. And they did that for some period of time. And I remember saying to my producers, hey, guys and gal, I could do this too. I don't think it's legal, or I don't think it was legal. It wasn't ethical. It wasn't moral to steal the money. But I could have told my producers, okay, you're off on Monday, call it in as unemployment, get your $600. You're off on Friday. You're off on Wednesday. I could have done it, and it would have benefited my staff to the tune of thousands of dollars. The public schools, at least some of them, did that. And I think that's fraudulent. I think it's deceitful, even though it may be technically legal. Do you know whether or not that happened in Washington State?
We have not heard cases of that happening specifically in Washington State. However, that does sound exactly like the kind of strategy that unions and school districts do try to pull. They are, you know, bureaucratic monopolies, and when the rules change, they will definitely work the rules in order to gain an advantage.
I think it might be interesting if Washington Public Policy called the employment division and said, can you go back to 2020 and 2021, or 2020 when the extra $600 a week was going on, and see how many people classified as teachers working were filing one unemployment day a week to be able to qualify for that extra $600 a week, because that was shortchanging, that was cheating the system to the tune of about $2,500 a month per teacher times thousands of teachers. I'd be fascinated to know what you find out. That's Paul Guppy, Vice President of Research at Washington Public Policy Center. Glad to have your calls in a moment at 866-A-LARS. Was a man who rioted and vandalized during the 2020 election arrested in Portland because he's a lefty? We'll get into that. We've got some other things to talk about as well.
wise words from President Reagan.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us. We the people are the driver. The government is the car. And we decide where it should go.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And in a moment, I want to tell you why the liberal panic can now begin. Because the polls are showing that Donald Trump is going to win in November, and the race is 7 months from being over. The nominations haven't even officially been given to Donald Trump and Joe Biden, although we know the two parties are going to do just that, unless, of course, the Democrats figure out a way to kick Joe Biden to the curb and then get rid of Kamala Harris at the same time, because she's an absolute loser of a candidate. We'll get to the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the program. Glad to have you with me for Honestly Provocative Talk Radio. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let me go first to Jake. Hey, Jake, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
I had a question on how the government gets away with telling us that we have to drive an electric car. Where did they get the authority to do that? In 1916, they didn't demand that we all get a car and get rid of our horses.
No, and do you know that when Henry Ford came out with his first Model A,
Yes.
Do you know that one-third of the cars on the roads in America at that time, about 1916 or 16, or 18, a third of the cars were electric cars?
Yeah.
Now, do you know why they went away?
Because of the cost of the batteries and being able to recharge them.
Yeah, and because with a gasoline-powered car or truck, you could throw an extra can of gas in the back. Kind of hard to throw an extra battery in the back of a battery car. They're not very practical. But here's how they're going to do it. And they've been doing it to some extent for some time. There's a thing called corporate average fuel economy. And what they do is they tell all the car companies, the Japanese ones that are located in America and the American car companies, they say your whole fleet has to have an average fuel economy. I think the number is about 35 miles per gallon now. Now, if you've got a pickup truck, does your pickup truck get 35 miles to the gallon?
No.
Okay, of course not. A good one might get 20. Right now. So you say, well, how do you get to 35 if a lot of your vehicles, the most popular vehicle in North America is a pickup truck? You have to have a whole bunch of little dinky cars that all get really high mileage, so you have a corporate average of 35. They want to push that number up dramatically. That's one way they're going to push you out. The second way is this. Joe Biden is telling the Congress, we, through the EPA, not through the people's representatives, but through the bureaucracy, the deep state, the EPA is going to say by 2030, we want 60%, I think the number is 60 now, 60% of the cars that are sold by car companies must be electric or zero emissions, which these days means electric. That means only 30 or 40% of the cars can be gasoline or diesel. So two things are going to happen. Number one, they're going to mandate that when you walk on a car lot, if there's 100 cars there, 60 of them will be electric by government edict, not passed by your members of Congress. The other 30 or 40 can be gasoline or diesel, but as they crunch down the supply of gas and diesel stay popular with the public, what do you suppose is going to happen to the cost of all those gas and diesel cars in just a couple of years?
It's going to go up.
It's going to go up dramatically. Because you're going to walk on the lot, Jake, I would imagine, and say, I want a gas rig. And they're going to say, well, I'm sorry, sir, but they only give us so many of them. So obviously we're adding extra dealer markup. You're going to pay through the nose for one of those. On the other hand, you can get one of these shiny new battery cars or even a pickup truck. And we'll even throw in the government is throwing in a subsidy to encourage you to buy it. So you're going to be presented with a choice. Do you want a really expensive gas or diesel rig, or do you want maybe the same cost and you buy the electric rig, and they got lots of those and not very many of the gas and diesel? That's how they're going to force you into that rig. Does that answer your question?
No.
It doesn't. No. It doesn't make you happy, but does it answer your question?
Yeah, I suppose it does.
Well, let me give you an example. You got light bulbs in your house, right?
Yes.
Do you have any incandescent bulbs, or you have mostly LEDs?
Incandescent, mostly.
But when you buy new bulbs, can you find them anymore incandescent, or do you find mostly LEDs?
No, just LEDs.
Yep. Now, here's how they did that. Because it is technically true that they did not ban the incandescent bulb. However, they said you must get, you can buy any in old-fashioned light bulb you want as long as it produces 60 watts of light for 17 watts of electricity. So, buy any bulb you want. You say, well, there is no such thing as an incandescent bulb that puts out 60 watts of light for 17 watts of electricity. And they say, that's right. So you'll be buying an LED bulb. They can officially claim that they did not ban the incandescent bulb. They merely made the standards so tight that you can't buy a bulb, an incandescent bulb that actually meets the government standards. And that's where we are. Let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron in Tacoma, thanks for listening. What's on your mind?
Oh, a couple things. You were saying earlier that Schumer, he's not going to comply with the Constitution. I'd say maybe it's time for a recall there. But here's the big thing. I don't know if you know about this. You know, well, WCW exposed back on February 15th that the USDA was putting up millions of dollars for dangerous bird flu, gain-of-function experiments in Wuhan, China again.
And yeah, we've talked about that on my show as well, because we're still funding research in China, and we're funding government research in Denver, Colorado, where they have a biosecurity lab as well, and they're still doing gain-of-function research, and it shouldn't be happening. But it benefits Joe Biden, so what's not to like, right?
Well, that's really wonderful, because in Texas is now reporting that 1.6 million lame hens are going to be destroyed, and two of our biggest egg farms in the United States, Michigan and Texas, now have, guess what, bird flu.
Yep, and guess what? Eggs are going to go back to, what, $9 a carton or whatever the peak was. Maybe Joe Biden will be able to drive groceries up even more than he did in 2022, because that's what he does. He takes actions that drive the cost higher for average people, and then he runs around the country telling you how fantastic the Bidenomics is and how much it's doing for people. Let me tell you the results of that poll, though. I got to do that, Ron. The Wall Street Journal has a brand new poll. It finds that Donald Trump is leading Joe Biden in six out of the seven battleground states. Now, they call them battleground states because those are the states that are pretty close to 50-50, meaning either a Democrat or a Republican could win. States like New York and California tend to go almost automatically for Democrats. Conservative states like Idaho and Texas, they tend to go liberal states, New York and California. Texas and Idaho tend to go for the conservative candidate. The battleground states are where there is a question mark about who's going to win them. And what do the polls show right now? Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and North Carolina, all battleground states, are going to go to Trump. Trump has a 6-point lead over Biden in North Carolina. He has a 5-point lead in Arizona, a 4-point edge in Nevada, 3-point advantages in Michigan and Pennsylvania. He is ahead of Joe Biden by one single point in Georgia, and they are tied in Wisconsin. Can you see why the White House right now is making plans? I think they think it's a fairly good assumption that Donald Trump is going to win in November, and that's Joe Biden. He's already going to lose, and we're 7 months out from Election Day. Glad to be with you, and always take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest
Network. The Lars Larson Show. Just listen for 5 minutes. You'll feel better. More with Lars Larson right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, California's new $20 minimum wage is already destroying jobs in the state of California. In fact, I saw what I consider a truly sad story. I don't know anything about the company, but apparently it's a local homegrown ice cream joint called Foster's. And apparently on Monday or Tuesday, they had to give all their workers a pink slip. Say, we're done, we're shutting down, you're no longer needed, goodbye. And that's a sad thing to see. And I know the workers said, well, you know, they should have given us more notice. Well, they knew the $20 minimum wage increase was coming. It began on April Fool's Day, believe it or not. But what a lot of businesses probably didn't know was the collision. increased energy costs, increased labor costs, a diminished economy, people with fewer dollars in their pocket to spend, especially on fast food, and all that comes together and slam, all these jobs simply disappear. So I thought we'd talk to David Newmark, who's a professor of economics at the University of California, Irvine, visiting scholar at the Hoover Institution, and all-around good guy. Professor Newmark, welcome back.
Thanks so much.
Hey, I had to throw that in. I mean, economists are good guys. I mean, if you put, I understand if we lined up a bunch of economists, they'd all point in different directions, but that's an old joke. So,
well, that's probably true.
Is that true? Tell me about this. Is this going to be a colossal disaster for California, or am I overstating the case?
You're overstating the case.
Okay. Fair enough.
Let me just, because I'm a professor, and I'm an educator, let me just correct a couple things first
okay.
of all. You know, the economy is doing great. I think we got to look at the data and is it doing great for everybody at all times? No, and it never has. You know, real wages are rising, especially at the bottom. So I don't think it this necessarily in any sense piles onto the doom and gloom, because I think the doom and gloom is wrong. That said, I think there are some serious costs to doing this, and we'll get to those. Is it colossal? No, because it's just the fast food industry, you know, and it's going to be good for some workers. Obviously, if you keep your job and you're in a higher wage, you're happier. But obviously, if you lose your job, and there will be some job loss, or if your hours are reduced a lot, you're worse off. And those effects are going to be concentrated among the roughly 500,000 fast food workers in California. And then there will be price increases, probably on the order of everything I'm going to say, hopefully, is based on past research, on the order of 3 to 4.5% at fast food restaurants, which isn't a lot. It doesn't sound like a lot, but there's two really important things to keep in mind. One is there's a lot more people buying fast food than working at fast food restaurants. So it's a small cost, but spread over lots and lots of people who probably go to fast food restaurants lots and lots of times in the year, hopefully not lots and lots of times a week, because that's probably not very healthy. And finally, who consumes fast food? Well, we probably all do sometimes. If I'm stuck at the airport,
I try
go
to
McDonald's.
Avoid it, but yeah,
the price is going to go up as much for me and you as a poor high school dropout, right? Prices don't differentiate. And no big surprise, those folks spend a higher share of their income at these kind of places than you or I do. Even if they don't go anymore, it's just their incomes are much lower. So in a sense, what we're trying to do, obviously, is one way or another, redistribute some income to low-income families, and all rich societies do that in one way or another, and we can talk about that. But this is a really ineffective way to do it, because it's not clear you're helping poor families much at all. Partly, a lot of minimum wage workers aren't poor families. You know, the teenager behind the counter is likely to be in an upper middle class family as a poor family. And a lot of poor families with working age adults have no workers, and this doesn't help them either. So it's just a really expensive way, an inefficient way to try to achieve what I think is the underlying goal, which is provide more income to the lowest income families.
Well, Professor, let me ask, do you let your students push back at all?
Absolutely.
I'm going to be your student.
I downgrade them if they don't.
Okay. So you say it's only going to affect minimum wage, but what happens when the fast food joint that was paying its manager $21 an hour and the workers are making, say, 17 or 18, and now all of a sudden the average worker, the newest person who knows absolutely nothing, walks in and is making 20, don't you have to bump the manager now to 23 or 24 or 25? The wage differential gets pushed up by the people at the bottom?
Yes, and there's some evidence that happens. Some people call those knock-on effects, which I think is a funny expression. But yeah, that does happen to some extent, and it happens for kind of the reason you're intimating, which is you're trying to build them some incentives, you know, get some training, get past 6 months probation, whatever it is, and you're going to earn more. And if that differential gets smaller, whatever incentive you thought you were creating sort of gets weaker. So there is some evidence that when you go, this varies a bit from study to study, but maybe 20 to 25% above the minimum wages get pushed up. But that's a much smaller share, but you got all these people earning less than 20. Now, don't forget, wages in California are pretty high, but nonetheless, you have, tens or hundreds of thousands earning less than 20 who all get pushed up to 20 if they still have their jobs. And that's where the really big cost increase comes from. That's why I don't know if this Foster's ice cream place closed because of that, but will there be closings? I'm sure. And will there be fewer openings?
I think they probably sat down and looked at their bottom line and said, look, we've got this much money coming out, and under the new wages, this much is going to go out the door. And wages are usually only a third of restaurant costs. The other two-thirds are bricks and mortar and food. But the one-third is labor, and if your labor costs go up, let me ask you about this. So you mentioned wages are real wages are going up. So you say that real wages have gone up more than inflation, and I mean real inflation, not the phony number we use right now for inflation, that wages have risen faster than inflation?
Well, I would just dispute the phony number. I actually know many, many, many people who work in government agencies producing data, and data get revised. That's because we learn more over time. But there are very few more credible data sources than the U.S. statistical agencies.
Okay. Can I ask you one specific question?
For sure, right. There has been inflation, and the wage gains, if you just look at wage gains, vastly overstate the real wage gains because prices have gone up a lot. So I'm talking, you're talking to the 1-3% a year, not, not nominal wage growth, clearly.
Well, about the phony number, I talked to several economists. One of them pointed out we used to measure inflation differently in the 70s than we do today. And she said, Veronique de Rougis, she said, look, if we measured inflation today the way we did in the 70s, which she thought was more honest, Joe Biden, who peaked out at 9 for the high of his term so far, although he may eclipse that, who knows, would have been more like 18, and today's inflation might be more like 7 or 8. But they changed the way they measure it, changed the way they state it. Is that accurate?
Well, my understanding, I don't know who she is, but that doesn't mean she's, I'm not saying she's not credible, but that doesn't mean that I don't know who she is. My understanding, when there have been serious looks at how to measure inflation, and there are complications, right? What do you do with a good that didn't exist before, like a cell phone, right? What do you do? How do you deal with all the stuff we have for free, right? Like Google Maps. I remember I used to drive around with my dad. He'd get lost for hours. That doesn't happen anymore. So there's all these things that are hard to price. But, what I understand from the literature is we might be understating it a little bit. Some people say we might be overstating a little bit, but again, I think that's different from saying, and I'm not saying you said this, but when people say it's phony or it's fake or whatever. Yeah. I phony, these are hard problems that they work really hard to solve. And of course, the problem is you don't want to keep changing the way you do this every year because then it really gets hard to compare. So I think what happens with these processes is we sort of do it the same way we've been doing, and then when we realize the problem is big enough, we spend a lot of money to try to figure out how to do it better. But
absolutely right. Professor David Newmark, Distinguished Professor of Economics at the University of California, Irvine, Visiting Scholar at the Hoover Institution. Back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
He does the work so you don't have to, bringing the political heat. He's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. I know a lot of you had a reaction to Professor Newmark, who's an economics professor, and I don't agree with all of them. I honestly don't agree with his assessment that wages have even kept up with inflation, which means in 3 years, if inflation is up 22% and your wages are up by 15%, you're running 7% behind the eight ball right now. And I'd mention that case of Foster's Freeze, one of the little businesses in California that's been hit by this $20 minimum wage. Monica Navarro, former assistant manager, shared her dismay. She said, it would have been nice to have some notice so we could all get some applications out. I could prepare them. I want to tell you this as well. About 3 years ago, I kept harping on the fact that there were 11 million open jobs in America. I guarantee you that right now, people, and I know a few people who are looking for work right now, are finding the jobs are not easy to come by anymore. which means that if you say, well, if I don't like this job and I'm not making enough money, I'll just go out and find a new one, that may be kind of tough. Let's go to Matt. Matt's calling in from White Salmon, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Matt, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I called in to get some unemployment benefits, and I give more.
Matt, White Salmon is not doing you any favors when it comes to cell phones. Let's see if we can get him to a cleaner line, and we'll go from there. Let's go to J.D. Hey, J.D., welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hello, Lars. Have you chosen to expose the name of the elementary school where that incident occurred?
I can tell you the name of the school where it occurred because, I don't mind saying that. I just figure I put the blame on all of Portland Public Schools because can you imagine that if that principal, and I'll get to the name here in a second, I didn't deliberately leave it out. This is the school where a 9-year-old girl was raped in a bathroom. Her rapists were identified in part because a father took the really correct decision. He found out somehow that his son had been involved in it. It was Scott Elementary School in Northeast Portland. And the father, like parents find out about the garbage that sometimes our kids get up to, he called the school and said, look, my son was involved in assaulting a girl. And you know, imagine the courageous nature of that. For a father to turn his own son in, I think it was a good idea. But it was Scott Elementary School. But when the principal of that school got the phone call from a father saying, my son was involved in sexually assaulting a girl at the school, when he decided how that principal was going to handle it, whether I think it's actually a woman who's the principal of the school, do you think she didn't call the superintendent's office and ask the big boss, what should I do with this? I can just about guarantee you she did. Don't you think?
Yes, but I also looked up the proficiency and teacher ratio. If you're interested, they have
Please tell us.
One teacher for every 14 students. Is that what the union calls crowded?
Well, can I tell you something, JD? If all you did was look up the number of students and the teachers, I'll tell you what's deceptive, and it's actually a problem. It indicates a problem. I did the same thing for Seattle Public Schools, but in the Portland Public Schools, if you take all the certified teachers who work for the district and you divide the number of students by the number of teachers, you get 16-1. Now they say, well, we don't have enough teachers. And you say 16-1 sounds pretty good. The problem is so many people who are certified teachers who work for the district don't work as full-time classroom, or they're full-time, but they don't work as classroom teachers. They're specialists of one kind or another. They're ESL. And so they'll tell you all day long, well, we've got 26 kids in a classroom. You say, how do you have 16-1 ratio teachers to student, and yet you have a classroom with 26 kids in it? And the answer is they got a whole bunch of teachers who aren't doing classroom teaching. They're doing something else. They're on the payroll. That's problem one. Problem two is there are more than 8,000 people, for example, who work in the Portland Public Schools. Less than half of them are teachers. Now, does that make sense to anybody that you'd have a school district saying our primary job is educating kids? Okay, is that what most of your 8,000-plus workers do? No, the majority of them do something other than teaching.
Union teachers that don't teach. Understood. How about their math and reading proficiency rating?
What are those numbers?
School?
What are they?
Their eighth graders have a 19% proficiency rating in math upon graduation.
Wow.
19%, which my math says that's 81% failed.
Yep.
And a reading proficiency of 24%. And
yep.
That's much better.
75% fail, 76% failure. You're right. And so you have a failing educational model, which I mentioned in the opening segment today. So you've got a failing educational model, and the schools are demonstrably dangerous to the kids. Why would any sensible parent leave their kids in that situation?
Yeah, agreed. I can clear up one of your taglines on the 57 Islamic state, 57 states.
58,
Obama's always quoting.
Yeah.
I spent a year on a mountaintop in an Islamic country when I was in the military. And there are 57 Islamic states.
I thought there were 58, but whatever. Obama actually said that in the Pacific Northwest during his campaign for president. He said, we've been to this state. We got 57 more to go. Apparently, a president who didn't know how many states there are in the United States of America, but he is a constitutional scholar. He'll tell you that all day long and twice on Sunday. You got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call it crackhead.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. It is the Radio Northwest Network, and we provide honestly provocative talk. In some cases, on a daily basis, we do it as a warm-up act for my friend Ari Hoffman, who's on our Seattle affiliate station, KVI, and Ari joins me now. Ari, how are you? How's life treating?
Always a pleasure, buddy. It's going great. It's going great.
Can you explain something to me? I understand the right of American workers, if they choose to be represented by a union, to collectively bargain. I actually think it's somewhat mentioned in the First Amendment when it talks about freedom of association, that you have the right to create an association of teachers. But what have these teachers' unions become, and I want you to focus on the Renton Education Association, which you've written about, that has become just about 100% a political organization, but it has all the funding that a labor union has, so they can go out and push politics that doesn't seem to have much of anything to do with representing teachers in the Renton schools.
No, or the kids for that matter. I mean, think about this for a second. Police unions can't go on strike. Fire unions can't go on strike. But for some reason, teachers who are a public sector union can go on strike anytime they please. Now, what happened was the Renton Education Association, together with multiple other labor unions, had a teach-in, which was an anti-Semitic teach-in where all the source material they used was from Wikipedia and Al Jazeera. For those of you who don't know, Al Jazeera is literally the TV station for terrorists. So those are the sources they're using. There was no counterbalance. There was no counter argument, nothing. And several Jewish teachers and Jewish union members ended up at this event. One of them told me the following. The Renton Education Association is creating a culture of anti-Semitic and anti-Israel rhetoric that is being impressed upon the educators in the entire Renton school district, which means that's what they're pushing on the students as well. And when I followed up with this teacher, they said this is the garbage they're teaching in the classroom.
Yeah, in fact, the woman you talk, I think it's a woman, Dobble, is that the name? Dobble?
Yeah, Juliana Dobble, the head of the Renton Union, Teachers Union.
And this is the person who says she is a socialist, does not recognize the state of Israel, believes in restorative justice. That's where the rapist and the rape victim are supposed to sit down and have a nice conversation and come to terms. Or maybe the murder victim's family and the murderer are supposed to sit down and have a conversation and come to an understanding about what happened. So she believes in that. And she hopes to drive out capitalism from our society. And this is the person who's representing the teachers in the Renton School District?
Yes, and she knew she was going to get called anti-Semitic, so she has this primer that looks like it was written by one of these far-left groups that says, here's why I'm not really anti-Semitic, but she put it up even before this thing happened, which means she knew exactly what was going to happen. She knew exactly what she was doing, but if you look around, we have the same problem in the Seattle Teachers Union. We have the same problem in ones across Washington. We see them in ones across the country. We see them in the NEA. We see them in all the teachers' unions. This is the garbage they're pushing, because for them it's about this intersectionality garbage of who's the victim today. And for them, they think terrorists are the victims today, so they're representing them. I mean, think of the teacher Ian Golash, who we covered at length from the Seattle Public School District. This is a guy who has posters of terrorists hanging on his walls. This is the guy who says the October 7th massacre never happened. This is the guy who rioted with BLM and Antifa in 2020, took students to these things, and got paid a six-figure salary by the city of Seattle for rioting when he claimed his rights had been abused by the police department.
Now, Ari, tell me this. Do any of these folks think that we're going to forget about this when the next levy drive or capital funding drive arrives at the ballot box?
Well, I think they are misunderestimating, to quote somebody else there, they are misunderestimating the power of the voters. I mean, look at Seattle City Council for a minute. So I don't know if you covered this yet today, Lars, but there was this homeless encampment made up of illegal immigrants that decided to take over tennis courts at a local school here in Seattle. And the Seattle City Council member who represents that district is actually pretty much on the left, but she still has common sense. And she goes, no, this cannot stand. Even Seattle Public Schools said, no, we cannot allow this thing. I think these people, if they think that the voters are going to forget about their nonsense, I think they're in for a huge shock this election cycle.
Well, I got to tell you something, Ari. My take on that Garfield High School takeover, here's the picture I draw for you. A group of people show up illegally in your country, and you say, okay, one group says, one group helping these so-called refugees, illegal aliens, all of them. And they are illegally in the country. They're claiming refugee status. And I'll remind people, 86% of the time their refugee status is refused by the courts because they don't qualify. That is a fact from 2023. So the courts say, you're claiming refugee status, you're not one. And that's the decision. And so if 86% of them are just here illegally, and they say, we're going to give you some housing for a while, and when that runs out, they extort more housing. They basically move to somebody's tennis courts. They move somewhere else. They've done this four times now. They have managed to extort the community. In one case, it was Seattle that paid for it. Another case, it was a faith-based group. So you have a group of people who are here illegally, who almost all of them are going to be at some point kicked out of the country. And they've decided that the way they're going to make their way through life is extorting what they need. If you don't give us what you need, we will become obnoxious until you do give us what we need or what we want.
Yes. Yes, and let's remember the taxpayers suffered because of it. So yesterday, these tennis courts are well used by a minority community, by a low-income community. If you actually go on the Seattle Parks and Rec website, you see page after page after page of tennis classes, and they were gearing up for the next season. When I went there yesterday, checked this thing out while they were packing up to go back to the hotel because this whole thing was a stunt to try and get the funding, or a threat just to get the funding, I noticed that a Little League game was going on right next to it, and there were guards at the Little League game because these things are side by side, which means now taxpayers had to suffer. Taxpayers were displaced because of these illegal immigrants.
Well, and here's the thing, Ari. If I came and threatened you, I wouldn't do that because Ari's a friend. But if I threatened you and said, Ari, I'm going to punch you in the face if you don't give me $50. That's extortion. And by the way, in terms of the threat, while you and I have been talking in the last hour or so, some New Mexico public schools have been shut down in a lockout, you know, where they lock all the doors because of a threat outside. Do you know what the threat is? A bunch of illegal aliens that have apparently been apprehended near the school. And I want you to ask, does any American feel safe sending their kids to school when this kind of threat has been invited into the country by Joe Biden, is being welcomed by liberals in big sanctuary cities like Portland and Seattle, and it's literally putting your community at risk, and it's stealing from the community, and now the illegals are bold enough, they make videos about how to take people's houses, and they say, if you don't give us what we want, we'll go down and we'll occupy a space. Now, it's say peaceful so far, but is that going to continue? If you've got 10 million angry illegals in your country and they say, give us what we want, if you don't give us what we're demanding, we will be obnoxious. At what point does that turn violent? That's Ari Hoffman. His show follows mine on our Seattle affiliate. Back in just a moment, I want to talk about the horny hick from Arkansas who's going out on a book tour. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Hey.
He has small town politics with big town opinions. This is the Lars Larson Show. Try that
in a small town. Welcome back, Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I got a question for you, and then I'm going to go to some calls, including a naysayer. When the horny hick from Arkansas, that's Bill Clinton, goes out on his new book tour, yes, he's got a brand new book about who else? Him. Someone please ask him about his time on Sex Island, the airplane known as the Lolita Express, and his friendship with the late child rapist Jeffrey Epstein. Would you please do that? Do you think any reporters in America have the guts to be able to walk up to Bill Clinton while he's trying to pimp his new book about him, a brand new memoir called Citizen, describing his personal and political life after January 20th, 2001? Do you think anybody's got the guts to say, tell us about why you stayed friends with a child rapist like Jeffrey Epstein? Tell us about your trips on the Lolita Express. And I'll get into some of the details in that in a moment. First, I want to go to a naysayer. Let's go to JC. Hey, JC, as a naysayer, what is it that you and I disagree with or about that makes you a naysayer?
Oh, yes, Lars. Thank you for taking my call, like always. I kind of disagree on, and I know you've had callers, too, that called in, and they kind of disagree on your term of using, that you use for illegal aliens, called illegal aliens, which they're not illegal aliens anymore. They were probably one time when they crossed.
Who says they're not?
This is going to be really simple.
Are you saying they are not illegal aliens anymore? What do you want to call them instead?
Listen to me. I'm not much of a betting man, but I will bet you, and you've named the wager. I'm pretty easy going. Probably can cap it at a million. Don't want to go too much over that. But you pick out 10 people. I'll let you pick out 10 people. And they all have to be illegal. Is that fair enough? You can pick them out, right?
I don't know what you're talking about, JC. Well, I pick out 10 people.
You keep claiming you know these illegals, Lars. Which illegals are you talking about?
I'll tell you which ones I'm talking about. First of all, do you know any people who are here on a green card?
Yes, many.
And the federal the federal laws of the United States call them legal resident aliens. That's the technical term for a green card holder. Hold on, JC. They're legal resident aliens. Now, if those are legal aliens, what do you call the ones who are not here with a green card?
Illegal.
Right. So they're illegal aliens. What's wrong with that?
So which ones are those, Lars? Because even the people you're talking about have...
Oh, I can tell you which ones those are. I'm going to tell you the ones that have not gone through the process. The estimate before Joe Biden's massive tsunami of illegals were estimated... I don't know. Why don't you tell me what you want to ask and then shut up for a second and I'll answer your question because you asked me a question. I try to answer it. Okay. Hold on a second. What do you want to ask me, JC, and where do we disagree?
Because you're not using the correct term for these people, Lars.
And I asked you a moment ago, what is the correct term?
They're legal resident aliens right now.
Hold on. Somebody who came here illegally, you are saying is a legal resident alien. How did they become? JC, shut up for a second. I'm going to tell him to shut up. I don't care if anybody thinks that rude or not. JC, all these people who came here illegally, how did they become legal aliens?
Easy, Lars. They go through a process. Obviously,
no.
They're not very intelligent.
JC, I'm going to tell you something. I've talked to a dozen immigration attorneys about this and said, if you enter the United States illegally, can you legalize your status? And they said, yeah, by leaving the country, go back to your home country, walk into the American consulate, say, I would like to legally emigrate to the United States, wait an average of 5 to 6 years, fill out all the paperwork and come illegally. If you've come in illegally, there is no way to legalize your status unless Congress changes the law, and the law has not been changed.
Lars, that's a process. That's called the process. I've been saying that all along. There's a process.
Now, yeah, and right Congress process? Has not, not changed the law. Look, I've had people who are friends or fans of illegal aliens for the last 3 decades who've been trying to get Congress to change the law. I don't want the law changed, and apparently the people who represent us in Washington, D.C. do not want to change the law, so they haven't changed the law.
I agree with you, Lars, but I'm asking you, could you point out 10 people that are here illegally that don't have...
By sight? No, I don't do things that way. There may be idiot friends of yours who look at anybody who's Hispanic and say they're illegal. I don't do that. I judge somebody based on whether or not they're here legally. If they came from Canada, if they came from Vietnam, if they came from communist China and they came in illegally, they are an illegal alien. JC, you've wasted enough of our time. Let's go to Kevin. Hey, Kevin, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for taking my call. This is regarding the subject about the the minimum wage raise down in California and the fast food industry.
Yep.
And it's not so much a question. It's just kind of more of a comment, but that, I'm trying to understand how I totally understand from the point of view of the business, and it's like, in terms of, it driving up the cost by raising the minimum wage. And that, works of this nature, jobs of this nature tend to be, the high school age, just people just graduating high school or in their, last few
or
years.
Or retired people these days.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't even think of that. The friends of mine.
Oh, I've seen plenty of retired people work at McDonald's. But what's your point?
Sure. Well, what I'm getting at is that, as I understand it, from the time whether it's Roe versus Wade and all these other things, that people had less and less kids over the years, and now you got industries now that are accustomed to having people that didn't need living wages, to make a living on their own.
What is a living wage, Kevin? Kevin, what is a living wage?
Well, the living wage is where, the living wage, the expectation is put on people that there are people making a living working at fast food when they should be moving up in the world.
Yes. Let me sketch this out for you, and you tell me if you think it fits. So somebody comes out of high school. He's not spent a lot of time on the books. He doesn't have any skills or talents. He's got a girlfriend. She's the same way. Perfectly nice young couple, but neither one of them paid much attention to school, nor do they have any other skills or talents. Now, they walk out, and in California, if you can find one full-time job for each of them at the minimum wage, they have a household income of $80,000 a year. Now, that's not going to make you rich. It's not going to let you live in the best part of town, and especially in the big cities. But at $80,000 a year, why would you go out and do anything to increase your skills and talents at anything if you're already making 80 grand just for showing up and fogging a mirror?
Oh, absolutely. I'm inclined to agree with the site. Wages should not be brought up to that. But at the same time, as I understand it, there's less and less children. Less kids born.
Well, Kevin, I know that. We've got 3.5 million people graduating high school every year in America. That's number one. Number two, one-third of Americans don't work at any job at all. And that's working-age Americans, not disabled physically or mentally. Working-age Americans, we have 30% of the entire population that does not have a job. That's plenty of people to supply every job need in America at the right wages.
The Lars Larson Show.
Portland. About 13% are not working or in school as of 2022, which is kind of insane, but they're not really doing anything, which is just a wild term. But if you think about it, there's kind of a massive disconnect with Gen Z in reality that we haven't really seen in any other generation so far.
And the disconnect, if I'm reading you right, is to say, yeah, I think I'll just stay at mom and dad's, eat out of their refrigerator. I don't need to get a job. I don't need to go to school. I don't have that excuse. So I'll just hang out because life is nice here, not having to pay any bills, not having any responsibilities, and I don't have to show up 9 to 5.
Yeah, there's some of that. And there's also a disenchantment with the working world. And they created these online worlds of their own through social media and their access to the internet. that just doesn't line up with anything that they're seeing. And they're watching a lot of the broken promises, I think, from Social Security is falling apart, politics is so partisan, they don't believe anybody cares. They just don't see a reason to buy into all of these things that don't do anything for them. But they don't see anything else that they can buy into. This is the first generation that doesn't know life without the internet, so they don't really know what reality is. And if you see education, it's not telling them anything better.
How much of this is a failure of parents to tell kids? Tina and I told this to our adult kids way back when. We said, well, when you get to 18, you finish high school, you know, have fun during the summer. But after that, you're either in school and you can stay at home to go to school, or you can go get a job and you can, you know, make your own way. Are there parents who are failing to do what they need to do?
I'm sure there are plenty of parents that are failing to do that, but there's also a change in parenting over the years, right? We have so many broken homes now that a lot of parents are looking at the market and saying their kids can't support themselves too. So there's a reluctance to throw them out there and feel like you're abandoning your kid. Do I believe that you should be getting them out of their basement? Yes. But there's also a bunch of other social factors where a bunch of kids are reporting depression. Parents are over-therapizing their kids, and they don't know who to go to and how to actually get them out there.
I guess what I wonder is, when you say you can't support yourself, if you're not married yet and you say, I'm not going to get married for a while, you have roommates, right? I've had in my life as many as four roommates at a time. And you say, well, that's not the most comfortable way to live. And you say, no, it'd be nice to have the place all to yourself, but that's a luxury. And when you make enough money, you can afford that luxury. Are any of the parents factoring that in? Because when a kid says, well, I can't afford to have my own one or two bedroom apartment and pay the rent and pay all the other costs of living, say, well, then maybe you need a roommate. Well, I really don't want a roommate. As far as I'm concerned, want gets satisfied when you have the money to do it and you're earning the money. Are they letting the kids take the easy way out, say, oh, mom and dad, I can't afford to live the kind of lifestyle I want to live unless I live at your house? And they're saying, okay, stick around as long as you want.
I think there's some of that. I think there's some of it is probably loneliness on the parents' part too, where if you are do have a broken home, you're not incentivized to let your kid go either. So there isn't that push that there should be that is healthy. There's going to be that unfulfilling kind of emotional dependency on each other where they don't want them to leave, and then they're going to watch over their poor baby. And then some of them just, like I said, they can't get jobs with their, you know, gender studies major that they spent $100,000 getting over 4 years.
Yeah. Did anybody think to sit down and talk to them and say, when you get this gender studies degree, what's your day job going to be? And does it involve pouring coffee?
Well, no. And that's part of the problem, right? Is all the things that were pushed with this idea of education. I was promised if I get the college degree, then I'll just get the job and these things will all fall into place for me. And then once I get the job, I'll get some sort of pension or some sort of social security, and all of these things will fall into place. And a lot of that's just not happening. It's not, they're seeing it fall apart. They know that there's no social security waiting for them. There's no house that they'll be able to afford, so there's no way for them to actually see that kind of future. They're seeing a lot of marriages end in divorce, so there's a disincentive to date, and there's so much social media to replace it that they kind of fall into that ennui of what else is there.
And what's the fix for all this? Or does there need to be a fix? And God forbid the fix comes from government. I'd like to see it come from Gen Z itself, saying we're going to solve our own problems. Is that even likely?
I think there is some of that incentive, and I hate to see that you see it on social media, but that's where Gen Z expresses itself, right? So you see a lot of kids kind of going back to what are these hands-on on jobs. There's a bit more of a turn towards vocational schools, and what is welding, a lot more kids working for HVAC companies, something that works with their hands, especially among the men, and women looking more into the homesteading and what are these practical realities of life that can actually give them that fulfillment that means something. Kids are moving out into a bit more, well, west for Virginia, but those more rural areas to find that actual purpose in life rather than just sitting in an office or sitting on a screen. They're losing their trust in those experts who told them to go to school and told them to trust all this stuff, and they're taking care of themselves better. So you're seeing that slight trend in getting away from these things that have been forced down their throats that haven't led them to any actual happiness, fulfillment, or moving on in their lives, and have let them be perpetual teenagers.
And Sandra, I've got a lot of friends and family members who work in the trades, and they love it. They love the trades, and they get paid very well. They can make $80,000 to $100,000 a year. And if you're making $80,000 to $100,000 and your significant other is making another $40,000 or $50,000, you've got a comfortable lifestyle in all but the most expensive cities in America. So if it forces them to the trades are begging for people to come in and do that kind of work, and it's worthy work. I think it's more worthy than typing on a screen.
It's far more worthy and far more fulfilling, specifically for young men. Young men don't need to be sitting in an office on their butt all day. They need to be out there most of the time, especially young men who are stuck in college sitting at a desk. They don't learn very well that way. That's why you see a lot of them, I think, acting out more and keeping up those juvenile tendencies. Whereas if you have, I've had friends who've gone into electric work and they've been learning as an apprenticeship there, or welding, and they're actually physically involved and they can see the product that they've worked with their own hands at the end of the day. And that's what's making them happiest.
Yeah, that's the crowd that takes a shower at the end of the day, whereas the office crowd takes a shower at the beginning of the day. I looked at electrical work when my stepson was looking for a job a few years ago. I said, gee, you can go into one of these apprenticeships and you'll be making $100,000 a year at the end of 4 years. Isn't that good enough? And you don't have any college bills to pay either. It just seems like all of these kids who are going to college are saying, gee, I thought a degree in gender studies or ethnic studies or something else that ends in studies was actually going to lead to a job. And I wonder, I know they want to blame the politicians, and I blame them to some extent, saying everybody should go to college. That was a lie all day long, and we've talked about it on this show for a long time. But a lot of the young men and women, if they didn't say, well, how much does this job actually pay? Is it really worth $100,000 or even $50,000 to learn how to get this job? And wouldn't I be a lot happier if I went out and actually did something, like you said, work with your hands, make really good money, do something respectful, or you can be the DEI manager for some major corporation and just mess everybody's life up. That's Sandra Kirby. She's at the American Principles Project. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Call number 866-HEY-LARS. If you're a naysayer, straight to the head of the line. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
If you
school. Because over 30 million Americans don't know where their next meal is coming from. Hunger lives in neighborhoods all around us, but it doesn't have to. At Albertsons Companies and Safeway Foundations, we are on a mission to provide 1 billion meals by 2030. Because everyone should be welcome at the table. Learn more at nourishingneighbors.com. Let's break the cycle of hunger together.
It's one thing to be aware of breast cancer. It's another to do something about it. Here's to the heroes who are making a difference, who get out there and take action, who prove every day that they are so much more than a color. Here's to the people who are more than pink. Get involved at komen.org/morethanpink.
Biden's the pulling mullet.
Do you realize you can literally have Lars with you all day, every day? Podcasts at Spotify, Apple, SoundCloud, and live right now. What a time to be alive. Here's Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. And believe me, it's good to have a generator to back up the power when the power goes out. I know that myself. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. Call 541-ONAGEN. That's 541-ONAGEN. The poll on X today. It seems the Biden White House has already decided that Donald Trump being elected in November is inevitable, so they are putting their finishing touches today on a plan that would restrict Donald Trump from nixing civil service protections and firing a bunch of bureaucrats who won't do their jobs. So, should the rules let a president fire bureaucrats who won't do their jobs? My answer to that is yes, they should. And the Biden administration is doing this, I think, because they know that Donald Trump is inevitable and they expect that he may fire some of the deep staters, and they don't want that to happen. So just calculate that into your vote in November. You can find the poll at Lars Larson Show on X. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, let's start with a naysayer. Mark's on the line. Mark, what do you and I disagree about today that makes you a naysayer? And welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. I'm a big fan, actually. Your assessment or characterization of the father of the boy that participated in the rape of the 9-year-old girl.
God bless
courageous.
Him.
Well, no, here's where we disagree. I think he called the school to get the school to cover it up. I mean, that's what happens in schools in, up here. We've all heard lots of stories where kids are assaulted and the school covers it up.
Well, except for this, Mark, until the father called, the school didn't know about it. If the father had said, you know what, I'm not turning my own kid in, which I think would be cowardly and wrong ethically and morally, but if he had not called the school might never have known that it happened. And as a result, the parents of the girl might never have known that it happened. And I'd be willing to, would you bet me that there are parents out there who know their kid has done something really terribly wrong like that, and they don't say a word about it?
I'm sure there are.
That's question one.
How did the clarification for the when did the story break, or how did the police finally get notified?
They didn't, and that's part of the outrage, Mark. This is what is so. I mean, I really start to hate the actions of people who do these things. So 2 years ago, this 9-year-old girl is coerced into a bathroom by two boys. They pull down her pants and they rape her. And then nothing happens, right? Then one of the fathers of one of the boys finds out, probably by overhearing something or seeing something or reading a message or whatever he did. He decided, my boy's been involved in this. He called the school. Now, the law in Oregon and all 50 states says that if you're a teacher, nurse, doctor, cop, all kinds of professions are required under the law that if you even suspect the abuse of a child, sexual or otherwise, you are required by law to report it. And if you don't report it to the police or Child Protective Services or both, you have committed a crime. So what did the school do? They learned about it from the father. They said, we're not going to call the cops. Portland Public Schools did not call the police. That means people, I don't know how many people, maybe just the principal, maybe the principal and the superintendent, they committed a crime, the crime of failing to report. Now, what did they do? They said, we will do our own investigation. Now, Mark, do you think that any school administrator is an expert in doing any kind of criminal investigation, let alone the kind of investigation involved in the sexual assault of a child?
No, and furthermore, no. I would say that the school is not a judge, a jury.
Nope. But they did. They took the place of all of that, and do you know what they decide, Mark? I don't know. Do you have any little girls in your family?
I have a daughter, yes. She's 18.
Okay. God forbid this ever happens to her. But if she had been sexually assaulted, do you think a one-day suspension from school would have been adequate as punishment for the boy who did that to your daughter?
Absolutely not. And that's
well,
why
that's
I think
what
that,
the, that, but that is exactly is, that is
that
huh?
they, is that they the school basically adjudicated the matter.
Yeah,
and a one-day suspension.
And I got to tell you, Mark, they're doing this more and more. It's one of the reasons, one of the sneaky reasons they wanted the school cops kicked out of the schools, and why Portland schools and a lot of other schools kicked the cops out. They don't want kids who commit crimes, sometimes crimes as ugly as rape, to face criminal consequences. And I think that's insane.
What I think it is, it's a cultural problem. I really do think that.
Well, what culture?
Problem.
No, but in what culture? I mean, what bizarre culture anywhere on planet Earth do they believe that sexually assaulting a 9-year-old girl is something that you shouldn't tell the police about? What culture has that belief? The Nambla culture?
The liberal left culture.
Well, there. Okay, you're probably right about that. So you've got a whole bunch of schools filled with people who are willing to violate the law to protect a rapist who think that they should excuse the rape of a little girl, and her rapist, both of them, should get a one-day suspension from schools. That is Portland Public Schools. They have committed a crime, and if all the other reporters start demanding an answer from Portland Public Schools and say, why did you break the law, and who's going to get prosecuted for it, we might get some satisfaction and some justice.